This season of Real History is brought to you by the Real History Patrons. Join now to support the show at patreon.com/realhistorypodcast. Welcome to Real History, shows what you know about history. On this podcast, we talk about historical movies and television, anything that claims to be based on a true story, and we check how bad did they mess it up? What was life actually like during that time period? Well, that's why we're here, to separate the real history from the real history. My name is Jacob Burrows, and I don't know anything about history.
And my name is Michael Tynan, and I'm full of nachos and cheese.
My name is Mark, and I am now fully caffeinated.
I don't know where this thing came from, where we're just saying what we're full of. I'm full of tea in all of our episodes, if we're keeping count, but yeah.
I think my state of caffeination is usually what I reference.
It's usually relevant as well.
It is, yeah. So whether or not I can actually speak for,
we have him
minutes.
On an IV drip here, just slowly being pumped into him.
Yeah,
sleep. Who needs that?
Keep him going.
And this week we're talking about Spike Lee's epic biographical drama, Malcolm X, that he released in 1992. So we'll need a lot of caffeine to get through this one because it is 3 hours and 20 minutes. Not the podcast, but the actual movie.
The podcast will not be 3 hours and 20 minutes. Well,
don't jinx it.
It's on you to stop me.
This film, I hadn't seen it. I watched it just for this. Spike Lee films, I feel like I've seen more of them than I have.
Yeah,
I've seen bits of them or seen them referenced. Yeah. I've seen a few, obviously, in full. But yeah, this one about Malcolm X, it's a long one. And it is, as I said, it's described on Wikipedia as an epic biographical film. And it really feels like it too.
Yeah.
It's really well put together, I think.
Yes. It's unbelievable performance from Denzel Washington. I mean, I am a mark for Denzel Washington. I think he's great, but he's really extraordinary in this, I think.
And this is a topic you've wanted to cover for a while, Mark. It's kind of one of your favorite.
Yeah, you know, I've sometimes said before, this I really like this person from history or whatever, or I have a favorite person from history. I think in one of the series we did, Kingdom of Heaven, I was like, Saladin. It's one of my favorite people. Malcolm X is also one of my favorite people from history. I just think he's really, really fascinating and one of the sort of the titans of the 20th century. So
absolutely, yeah,
yeah. And as far as the details of the film, do you have? I mean, obviously Spike Lee directed it. Denzel Washington is in it, but what else should we know for those who haven't seen it?
Slightly buried the lead there.
Yeah. Well, I suppose with Spike Lee, if you don't know him for this, you might know him for other films like Inside Man, Black Klansman. I think his last one
Inside Man, the bank job movie.
Yeah.
Did he make that?
Yeah. Gordon, yeah.
Wow.
Okay. The Five Bloods as well. I don't know, I think it was a Netflix release a couple of years ago.
Yep.
Something like that. I haven't watched it. But
it's Chadwick Boseman, I think.
He tends to make very good films, I would say. And apparently he studied at the feet of Martin Scorsese in New York University, NYU.
Wow.
And a lot of people have commented on this film, actually, when I was looking into it a little bit, that this came shortly after Goodfellas was released. And a lot of the tone of the movie, maybe in terms of the flashbacks, you know, the way the story is told at the moment, but there's also flashbacks and even just the structure of it, they say, is very similar to that type of Scorsese.
I could see that, and the editing is a bit abrupt at times.
It is, yeah.
It's not shying away from doing very kind of things that draw attention to the fact that you're watching a movie, like weird placements of sound effects or things like that, but combined with a very high production value as far as the amount of people on the screen, the neighborhoods they're going through, and sort of the sets and everything. It all feels, I don't know, it's larger than life while feeling authentic.
Yes, yeah, that's a great way of describing it, yeah.
And you can really tell when you're watching the film that these are tumultuous times in American history.
Yeah, you can really feel that in the scenes.
That tension is there all the time, and I'd imagine it's hard to capture that on film. Mm. I can only imagine what it must be like to live through it, but to capture it on film is a feat in itself.
There's a scene at one point, it's Malcolm X and some of his guys are walking through a university campus, and one of the students comes up to him. Do you remember that scene? And she's like, is there something we can help? And that's in the 60s on a university campus where there's, in the rest of the world, there's, you know, famously riots going on with students and the student activism and stuff. And the way they shoot Washington and his just just his brusqueness and his like ability to just dismiss this person. I just love the way that's shot, and you can just, as the camera like follows him, it's like a tracking shot, and he's walking towards the camera, and you can just see the woman stopping and the look of disappointment on her face as she fades out. The shot's brilliant. Like I love, there's loads of shots like that.
I think Denzel kind of makes the film. I know it's
It hangs on him. It really, really hangs on him. And like, what an actor to do it. Like,
well, I hadn't realized, but he had, years earlier, he had played Malcolm X's character on Broadway.
Oh, wow.
In a play. It was called When the Chickens Come Home to Roost. And I think that was a famous phrase that Malcolm X used soon after, very controversial at the time, after the death JFK. Of JFK. In terms of the screenplay and all that, all the kind of facts of the film, it was written by Spike Lee as well and Arnold Pearl. And it's based on the autobiography of Malcolm X, which was published in shortly after his death in 1965. And that was written by Malcolm X, but also by a journalist called Alex Haley. And I suppose it's important when we're reviewing this film as well to bear in mind, in terms of historical accuracy, and I know you've read a few different books on this guy, Mark, but, are you basing the accuracy of the film on how close it is to the autobiography and the events described by Malcolm X, or actually from what we can garner from history of the time itself and other sources? So it's a slightly unusual one for us to cover.
It's the same really for any more modern film that we're doing, right? Especially like a biopic or something like that, that it's just, like, we just recorded an episode that might not be out yet, but about King Arthur. And there, the thing is that we don't have any sources. Like, it's very scattered. And basically, you have some creative freedom as a filmmaker then in picking what to draw from and what to claim as real, versus an abundance of sources from a more modern day setting, right? Because you have to pick who to believe, because there's a lot of people saying stuff.
Even things like, you could include, like, you know, what TV shows he appears on, or radio shows he appears on, and how do you frame that? Like, is that are you framing it in a positive way or a negative way? All of those kinds of things. It's a different kind of challenge, I think, for sure.
It's funny because when he was writing his autobiography before his death, which we'll obviously get into, and he said to Haley, the journalist he co-wrote it with, if I'm alive when this book comes out, it'll be a miracle. Because he knew at the time even how, you know.
Well, in the main biography I read of his, Manning Marable's biography, which won a Pulitzer, and there's a lot of that book is talking about Haley trying to get his time with Malcolm to try and finish the book, and just being frustrated because Malcolm X just doesn't have time to give this guy. He's just so busy. He just doesn't have time for this guy. Like, you know,
With the civil rights movement and all that, we'll forgive him, you know.
He's
trying to protect his family as well.
He'll have to be getting on with it.
But yeah, in terms of it is certified fresh on Rotten Tomatoes, 89%.
Nice.
I think Martin Scorsese himself said that it was one of his top 10 films of the 1990s. So it is highly regarded, and definitely watch it. In terms of the cast then, excellent as well. So we've already said we've got Denzel Washington playing Malcolm X. We've got Angela Bassett playing Betty X, or who is essentially is Dr. Betty, so she becomes Malcolm X's wife.
Who people might know from various Marvel films. She's in
Black she's Panther a great, she's a great actor.
In many things.
Angela Bassett's a great actor, yeah.
And his sort of childhood, well, maybe not early, adolescent friend when he was in Gangland, Delroy Lindo, who plays West Indian Archie. He's a great character in the film.
Yeah.
Spike Lee himself makes a cameo as Shorty, who is sort of his partner in crime. I love how they're wearing the zoot suits. You know, the bright flamboyant colors, hats. Really sets the scene. And then Al Freeman Jr., he plays Elijah Muhammad, who's a very important character we'll go into, you know. That's sort of an overview of the cast, I suppose. there's lots of trivia about this movie, and I couldn't really limit like the amount of stuff. Like Spike Lee himself, for example, he encouraged children to skip school to go and see this film because he said it would give you, if not as much, that it would give you a better education than essentially what you would get in school. You could be right. Mm-hmm. Who knows? There was 3 generations of Washingtons in this film. So obviously Denzel was in it, but also his mother, Lennis Washington, makes an appearance, and his son, John David Washington, who later he starred in Tenet.
He's in Tenet, yeah.
And Black Klansman, which is another Spike Lee movie.
Joint. Or it's a Spike Lee joint.
They're called joints, yeah.
Joints. Ah, okay, fair enough, yeah. There's definitely no shortage of stuff here to talk about when it comes to this subject.
Yeah, for sure. And I forgot to give you the one sentence summary.
Oh,
but
yes, let's have it.
But I mean, it's about Malcolm X. You know, I feel like we haven't done many biopics or.
I was thinking that when you said earlier. I was like, have we done any?
We did on Darkest Hour. That's a biopic, I would say.
Of course, Darkest Hour.
Which, a biopic is held up so much by the actor, the main actor, always. But also, there's just more of a compelling story in this.
Yeah. And with the greatest respect to the creators of Darkest Hour, that movie doesn't hold a candle
at
all. Like, it's just not in the same realm at all.
But most people listening to this will have forgotten what Darkest Hour is. But
yeah.
So in this episode, we'll mostly be going over Malcolm X's life, obviously, and sort of inaccuracies in the movie or sort of critiques, things to go into more detail on than what we get to see on the screen. But if you're not familiar at all, this is the story. A young man transforms from a troubled criminal to a passionate advocate for black empowerment, following his conversion to a religious group that he eventually becomes disillusioned with, going on to form his own more inclusive ideology before he's assassinated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Excellent, Jacob.
Yeah, that one's just factual.
Yeah, but in one sentence, it's not bad.
So let's start from the beginning. Who was Malcolm X in his youth?
So is true with everyone, your youth is obviously, your childhood is obviously formative. Malcolm X had suffered some really, really severe repeated episodes of trauma in his childhood. He was born in 1925, Omaha in Nebraska. And the family his family name had been Little, so he was born Malcolm Little. And his father was Earl and his mother was Louise. And his father was a Baptist minister. Maybe for non-Americans, it bears kind of explanation of what that would mean. So a Baptist minister basically would have been an important person in a local community, or even in a region or a countywide community. As a preacher, he would be somebody who would typically be a very good speaker, be pretty charismatic, generally fairly learned men would do this job, and would have a lot of respect in the community. For Earl, obviously their family are African-American, and he was interested in Garveyism, which was a form of political thought and movement focused on Africans and black Americans based on the ideology of a man called Marcus Garvey. And Marcus Garvey was a Jamaican immigrant into the US who was a political theorist, I suppose, is the best way to frame it. I don't know if that's... He was a pan-Africanist. So he espoused principles around the black population looking towards self-sufficiency, and they were thought principles of separation from the rest of the sort of white-led society, the injustice of the white-led society, essentially.
Different so, branches as well.
Of course, yeah. No, Garveyism would have split into various different forms.
But even though it wasn't like that long ago, this was a time of explosive thought, right? Like, because this was early 1900s, Marcus Garvey was espousing his ideas, yes. And this was only 1925 that Malcolm X was born.
Yeah, and I mean the 20s in the US, like this is a transformative decade in the country. This is like the sort of the Volstead Act has been passed 5 years earlier. The sale of alcohol has been banned.
And what is the Volstead Act for those?
The Volstead Act is prohibition. Right. So basically, alcohol is illegal.
But I know that from Boardwalk Empire, but
yes. So this is this gives rise to the development of the organized crime in the U.S. The mafia families begin to form around this time. And bootlegging is rampant all over the place. And one of the great, one of the big pushes that got the Volstead Act over the line was the religious right. Was people like Baptist ministers preaching from the pulpit about the evils of alcoholism? You know, so this is a time when these kinds of figures are very important in the culture and in the society.
The idea of purifying the society of evil, solving all thing evil by through the law, essentially. You know. But anyone is just speaking briefly on Marcus Garvey. If anybody has ever listened to The Wailers or Bob Marley, you will have heard a lot about Marcus.
You know
Garvey
who Garvey is,
because he quotes him a lot, and a lot of the concepts around are discussed in their music. Even if you're only listening to it in the background, if you stop and listen to the lyrics, it'll give you an idea of kind of Marcus Garvey's point of view, as well. Lots of ideas around Africans or African Americans moving to Africa to establish homelands, such as in Liberia in West Africa and stuff like that. So very lots of kind of big ideas, I suppose, is what you would say.
Yeah, societally transformative ideas. Yeah. And Garvey is sort of an inspirational thought leader, I suppose, is a good way of describing him. But Earl Little had sort of, it's a bit unclear. I mean, the biographies will suggest he was a very, very powerful speaker. He's a very charismatic kind of speaker, as his son will obviously later become as well. And his sermons were effective, and his popularity was such that he drew the attention of the Ku Klux Klan. So his family and himself began receiving death threats fairly regularly, and it got to the extent that the family had to essentially keep moving because it was just unsafe where they were. Eventually in 1929, Little bought a 4-acre farm in Lansing in Michigan, which is a town I've been in, a nice town. And it was odd in that the family, when they moved to the area that they moved to, they were the only black family there. And it was very, very difficult, as you might imagine. The local council actually, this is insane to think of now, but the local council had a vote to remove the family because they were like, but this is a white area. You know, it's just insane. Like, you can't move here. There is a group that were operating in Michigan at the time, in around Lansing, who were sort of like an offshoot or a branch of the KKK called the Black Legion. And the Black Legion threw firebombs at the Little's house, like, and Malcolm X is 5 when this is happening.
Yeah,
they've moved several times. They're getting death threats. He obviously doesn't know what a death threat is. He's a child, but like, the house is being firebombed.
And on the note of, since we're always talking about film and history, like, the Ku Klux Klan is seeing a rise during this time, partially because of everything that we're discussing and rising racial tensions.
Yes.
Also because of D.W. Griffith, that motherfucker who made Birth of a Nation.
This
one of the first blockbuster films that where the Ku Klux Klan are the good guys who sweep in and save the day at the end, and it actually had a significant impact on the growth of the organization. And now we're just a few years later, we're seeing them here featured in this biopic, because film affects people and changes how people think. Definitely. Just like, this is why Spike Lee wants you to go see his film instead of going to school, basically, because, you know, if you go and see Birth of a Nation, you'll end up a Klan member. So, there you go.
And I mean, one of the people affected by things, like the US president, Woodrow Wilson, perhaps the worst president in American history. Honest to God, like, a horrific racist, you know, and that was the guy who was the president, you know, up until, 1918, whatever, 1919, whatever it was. So, I mean, you know, these are explosive times. The house, when it's firebombed, it catches fire, obviously. The firefighters don't show up.
Yeah.
So nobody comes to save the property. So the family are obviously get outside and have to watch the house burn. But it gets worse. Earl Little is then accused of arson. He's accused of
burning his own
of
house.
Burning his own house. So I mean,
what's the logic there?
You know, they're just like, well,
isn't really,
yeah, yeah, just like, well, nobody's going to take the blame for this, so blame that guy. Like, this is obviously very formative, but Earl is later found dead, and he's killed in, and the movie portrays it like he's killed by what they say is a streetcar, a tram hits him. Now, it's not the most believable thing you've ever heard. Realistically, what's likely to have happened is, and what the film suggests, and what the biography suggests, is that his father was captured by clan members and they brutalized him and then threw his body in front of him.
Certainly what Malcolm X believed himself.
Absolutely,
anyway,
what he believed, And the arguments are that the injuries are not consistent with just the impact from a tram.
That he had been beaten.
Yeah, he'd clearly been beaten
beforehand.
Yeah. That's the suggestion. The problem here is this goes down as a suicide. So the life insurance don't pay out. And I mean, everyone knows that this guy's not killed himself. Everyone knows, you know. But in the face of that, the life insurance company's gone, no, we're not paying you out. We're not paying out. So you know, Malcolm X is left with his family being run just by his mother.
Impoverished. Really.
Absolutely impoverished. They don't have the income that the father had. So she takes small jobs where she can get them, does as best she can. But this woman is suffering from various health issues. She has various mental health issues. And that all comes to head when Malcolm X is 13 and his mother is actually committed to an asylum. And the family, himself and his siblings, they're split and are sent into different orphanages. So you can imagine a childhood where you sometimes feel like things are okay, then you're on the run, then your house is on fire, then your father's murdered, then your mother's taken from you and you're 13 years old and the rest of your family are also taken from you. So they're split up and they're sent into different orphanages. Malcolm took sort of refuge in school. So when he was in orphanage and he was attending school, he was a very, very bright student, which won't be surprising to anyone who knows anything about Malcolm X, but he's a fairly good student, and he's noted by his teachers as being very intelligent, very charismatic.
Very quick-witted,
yeah. Kids like him. He's a sharp kid. And there's an incident that he tells about in his autobiography where, and I think they do show it in the movie, where there's this kind of thing where the teacher's like, oh, what do you want to be when you grow up? And Malcolm says, I want to be a lawyer. And he's just dismissed by the teacher, you know, because you're a black child, you couldn't be a lawyer. Those kinds of jobs are not for people like you. That's basically what's said to him. And that moment, the way it's described in the biographies, is that moment is like a crucial turning point to him. It sort of breaks his hope in education, or in formal education, or the institutions of education. Maybe that's the way to phrase it. And so basically, he just drops out. He just thinks, what's the point in staying in school? I'm never going to achieve what I want to achieve through this. So this is a waste of my time. Mm. So he drops out of school. And by the age of 17, he moves himself to Harlem in New York. Now, why Harlem? Harlem is historically a black neighborhood, still a black neighborhood in Manhattan, where you will have at this time have had lots of folks coming up from southern states, moving into the cities in the north, for, you know, working industrial jobs and so on. And Harlem would have been a focus area for these kinds of people. So he moved to Harlem, and he began working in the kitchen. So he's basically working as a line cook. And while he's there, he starts to see the culture in New York and how racism is evident in the ether of the culture there, and that's borne out by the fact that white men are approaching him, asking him for drugs. Now, he's not a drug dealer, but people are approaching him and assuming that he is. Mm. Or they're approaching him and asking him, can he get his hands on this? Can he do this? Can he do that? Can he get stuff in the black market for them? Can he, you know, all of this kind of stuff? This is while he's just working in a kitchen, like, so you can imagine how ridiculous this is. But he sees this essentially as an opportunity, and he thinks, well, these people think I'm a criminal. Like, I've
already got, there's you know, there's demand.
Yeah, well, that's it. Like, they say,
someone's got to sort out the supply.
This is an innocent man who's never done anything wrong in his life and has had a horrible, horrible childhood and is working in the kitchen. And everyone's assumption is that he's a criminal. Now, I'm not trying to excuse somebody becoming a criminal, but you can see why somebody would be like, well, I'm already guilty without having committed anything. So he begins to engage in petty crime. Essentially, so he gets involved with a couple of friends of his, John Elroy Sanford, Malcolm Jarvis. These guys, they begin acting as, they push drugs, they get involved with some of the petty crime lords in Harlem and the neighborhoods around it, and he sort of becomes a bit of a lad about town, you know. And this is where the movie you were talking about, where they're in the zoot suits,
yeah.
Where they're dressed in this very specific style of very loud suits and hats, and like they just look like characters, you know, the like crazy dress. But they
I mean, the first scene in the movie basically, yeah, is them,
he's walking across the street and they walk in this really, yeah, specific, yeah, style,
making sure
stuff.
You get the walk right and, yeah, like got the hat and doing all the right moves, yeah,
yeah. For him, this is the only time he's had money, really, and he's, you know, and to him it's irrelevant that he's making it illegally, because the society views him as a criminal regardless of what his background or his intent is anyway. So, you know, there's no logic in his mind to not engage with what people are accusing him of in the first place, because he seems to now be getting ahead. In 1949, he's dating a white woman, along with his friend who was dating another white woman, and they are middle class, well, upper middle class, fairly wealthy women, you know, and who are disaffected from their families for whatever reason. And so the group, the four of them, decided they're going to rob the white women's family, because they, you know, they live in these nice houses out in the suburbs, and they know their parents aren't going to be home, etc. and so on. So they decide, Malcolm and his friends decide, let's break into these houses and steal what's there, steal the jewelry, steal the money. But then the ugly head of racism rears up again, and they get caught. And when they go to prison, the two white women just say they were forced. They were forced to do this, but the two men. Now, both biographies I read of this suggest that that's just a bald-faced lie. Like, you know, they absolutely planned this with them, because how would they have gotten into the house? Because there's every evidence in the world to suggest the women are complicit, put it that way. But of course they both get off, because they're middle class white women in New York. But Malcolm Jarvis and Malcolm X get 8 to 10 years in prison.
I suppose this is his life pivots on his time in prison, really.
It does. There's a lot in the biographies of talking about how he initially, when he's in prison, he's sort of I don't want to say radicalized, but he's sort of, what it's done is it's shown him that the life that he's had, where he's assumed to be a criminal before doing anything, is the experience that lots of other black men have had. And the way it's described in the biographies is that, like, he's surrounded by innocent black men who are in prison. So he becomes the sort of the inner anger at the injustice of his life really comes to the fore for him at when he's first in prison, and that manifests itself in a sort of a fury directed towards some of the other inmates who are religious, who are found religion or are using religion as a sort of a balm against their condition, or as lots of people do in prison. But he became really furious. He's like, this, you know, God has put you here, sort of thing, you know, and why are you wasting your time on this nonsense with a white priest telling you to repent your sins when you never even did anything wrong? You know, this kind of thing absolutely incenses, you know, he's absolutely furious. One of the inmates is a man called John Bambury, and he basically convinces Malcolm to turn his anger towards turn his anger towards getting himself through this process of being in prison. And the way he does that is he basically says to him, you have to read everything in the library, like, you know, and he says, "Don't read this week, read this book. Next week, you're going to read this book."
And the dictionary, or, even.
Yeah, the dictionary. Every book in the library, you read, like, you're going to read everything in the library. And this reawakens. And they do, in the movie, to kind of make it, they kind of call back to him being in school as a really bright child. And this sort of reawakens his intellect. And he just becomes this absolutely voracious reader, like an obsessively voracious reader, reading everything he can get his hands on. And he becomes really the definition of an autodidact. You know, he teaches himself about everything he can, everything he has hands on, geography books, history books, political books, everything. And this is really what gets him through the early years, you know. This is what sort of is his saving grace when he's in prison, is his love of knowledge, like, and his love of books and words. It also opens up in him the belief that, like, the power of debate and the power of convincing people. He starts to believe that, you know, you can change people's minds, and the systems that are in place now don't have to be the systems that are in place. Maybe things can be changed. You can convince people of the, you know, there's better ideas. That's the way it's phrased anyway.
I like in the film how when one of the prisoners who in the film is very influential. He didn't actually exist, I don't think, Brother Baines. And who says to him, and it kind of shows you his changing mentality, because he says to him, Elijah Muhammad can get you out of the prison of your mind.
Yeah.
And obviously we later find out who this person Elijah Muhammad is. But in the film, Malcolm X takes this literally. So when he's talking to this guy Baines in the sort of the rec area, you know, where they have their exercise, he's like, okay, well, how does this scam work? How am I going to get out? You know, like, so he's still seeing everything in his more adolescent way of how do I get out and go back to my old life. And then through this use of knowledge, and I think it's his brother and his sister who
So he's in contact with members of his family who had been separated from him when the mother had been committed. But they were still in contact, still wrote letters to each other. Malcolm had a good relationship with his older sister. Well, a mostly good relationship with his older sister. But they wrote to him saying that they were attending these meetings of the Nation of Islam, and that Malcolm would find solace and freedom through Allah, basically, which is like a phrase that the Nation of Islam would say. And initially he's just like, yeah, cool, whatever. Yeah, great.
I take it the film Spike Lee, when he eventually mentions to Spike Lee that he had taken interest in this, Spike Lee's character is a shorty. He's just reading a letter from Malcolm X in prison, and he's like, he's gone crazy.
Yeah. And it just cuts out like that.
Eventually, as much because he's basically read everything else there is to read, he gets Elijah Muhammad's book sent to him.
So it's not really from within prison that this religious influence comes at all.
No.
Like you said, he was rejecting people who were going to religion as a sort of opiate for the masses.
Yeah, that's really what his thing was. He thought this is just another system of control. That's really what he thought.
And he might have been right.
I mean, you know, let's be real. Like,
they use your man Brother Baines, who is a very good character in the film, you know. I suppose he's a composite character of a lot of different influences.
Yes, absolutely.
On his that led Malcolm eventually to the Nation of Islam.
And the actor in that we've also seen in Apocalypse Now.
Yes.
As Chief Phillips.
Chief Phillips.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And of course in Ally McBeal. Sorry, I'm just on.
Never forget.
Here. No, because I knew his face and was like, where?
Less familiar.
Yeah.
Where did I know him from? And it's definitely one of them too.
So Malcolm relents eventually. They send him Elijah Muhammad's book, which is sort of details the teaching of the Nation of Islam, which is a splinter group.
Is it a sect?
It's more of a cult.
Yeah. Hard to.
I don't. You know, look, I'm not an expert on Islam, like, but I would suggest to you that it's not accepted as true Islam, like, considering this guy is pretending to be a prophet, and the central tenet of Islam is that
the last prophet.
Muhammad is the last prophet, the final prophet, you know. in this book, it basically lays out Elijah Muhammad's, what Malcolm X would call teachings. And and I want to specifically say teachings because he had this phrase, which is repeated all the time when Malcolm X would speak. He would always say, Elijah Muhammad teaches us.
Yeah.
And you know, this is
as if he was saying, for argument's sake, Muhammad or Jesus of Nazareth, yeah, or whoever, yeah, the preacher was.
Framing him as a spiritual and moral authority, you know. Yeah. But the teachings essentially show that, like, that the black race, as he puts it, are suffering hell on earth, and the white men were the devils. We're the white devils oppressing the black man, and like, that's obviously the sharp edge of it. Like, but it would also encouraged education, and maybe above all else, discipline, self discipline,
abstinence from cigarettes.
You don't
alcohol,
smoke. You don't drink. You know. You don't
eat pork.
You don't eat anything to you don't do anything to excess. And you certainly don't eat pork. No, that's a no-no. But it also emphasized that a black man should have pride in himself. He should be proud of who he is and where he comes from, and these ideas. You can imagine a early 20s Malcolm X reading this kind of stuff and it reminding him maybe of his father's teaching about Garveyism. Yeah. You can see how these things would tie together, and he could find
self-respect for yourself.
Yeah, respect yourself. Maybe, and, like, you know, look, I'm speculating, but maybe this is opens up a sort of a part of his life that had been closed off because of the trauma, just the memory of his father, and, you know, his father's dignity in the face of incredible adversity, you know. So he's Malcolm buys this hook, line, and sinker, and he converts. And as part of his conversion to the religion, this is when he drops the surname Little. And explaining this as that's the name that my family took on because
it was imposed on them. Really.
It was imposed on them by a man who had, you know, who had enslaved them. Or
this is common in the nation.
This is a common move in the Nation of Islam, and the idea being that at a point in time you would take a new Islamic name.
Yes.
Yeah. And look, that's a practice within Islam generally, that you would take an Islamic name. But he starts referring to himself as Malcolm X, X being the mathematical signifier for the unknown, because he can't know what his family's true surname is or what the family's true name is. He becomes hugely inspired by Elijah Muhammad. In the movie, there's a very, and it's in the autobiography, but not in the actual biography, because it's clearly not a thing that really happened. But
he's the vision.
He has a vision of Elijah Muhammad.
Yeah,
and it's interesting because if you read him talking about it, it sounds, you could be forgiven for saying he's saying it like that, not meaning it to be literally true, but meaning it more of the Elijah Muhammad awakened his true self, but in the movie they do a literal interpretation, like Elijah Muhammad appears to him in prison, like, which is which was a bit wild, but that is what the autobiography says. So in fairness, the biography I read, the Manning Marables one, is like, well, I mean, that's clearly not happened, and he meant that as a sort of a, you know,
you could have been dehydrated. Yeah, maybe lacking sleep.
He was in prison and they weren't treated well. I mean, you
know. But this is the magic of cinema. Like,
yes, exactly.
You don't see that and go, oh, like, this religion is correct within this universe. You go, oh, we're within the mind of this person.
Yes.
This is what they've experienced.
It's actually powerfully done, I think, in the film. Like, so Malcolm X then sets about converting other prisoners, because he thinks he feels that, like, what he's gotten from it is alleviated so much of his stress and his inner pain that
he felt free, even though he wasn't in prison.
Yeah,
or even though he was in prison.
Yeah, though he was in prison, he felt like his mind wasn't anymore,
and he wanted to share this with others.
And he wanted to bring this sense of relief to his fellow prisoners, most of whom he believes were innocent of any crime anyway, like, shouldn't have been there in the first place. But also, people who were guilty, irrelevant. In his eyes, you know, he can be redeemed through Elijah Muhammad.
And was he successful in this? And if so, is that part of why he ended up kind of getting more involved in the church and becoming more sort of prominently
featured? He is successful. Yeah. He converts quite a lot of them.
Because that's actually not That's kind of missing from the film. In the film, he's converted by Baines, and then, you know, he's getting personal letters from Elijah Muhammad or whatever. And then when he's leaving, it's kind of like, oh, we expect great things for you or whatever. But this actually dramatically makes more sense that, oh, he's already doing the thing.
He's doing the thing. And he's doing the thing to such an extent that the prison wardens are worried because they start seeing that they're organizing prayers. And he's leading prayer groups, like, and people are following commands, and the prison wardens are worried,
so worried, in fact, are the
wardens that the authorities are notified about this, the FBI are notified about this.
Yeah, which obviously is in the film, but it's a lot earlier than you'd think.
Yeah. So his name is on a watch list, and he's in prison still. This is also what really brings him to the forefront of the leadership of the Nation of Islam, the success and the fact that he's being watched and that he's preaching the word of Elijah Muhammad. That's when Elijah Muhammad starts writing. They start writing back and forth to each other, and that's the kind of the driver for that. And he's an extraordinarily impressive man in the way he speaks, his communication skills are just,
he's magnetic,
charismatic, incredible writer, incredible speaker, and this. That bringing him to the attention of Elijah Muhammad meant that when Malcolm finally was paroled, he was appointed as the minister in Detroit. So the Nation of Islam had sort of branches in several of the major population centers. In the major population centers. So they had one in Detroit, they had one in Boston, and there's a couple of smaller ones. I think Elijah Muhammad might have been in California at that time. I'm not quite sure where he was exactly at that point. But Malcolm was appointed as the minister in Detroit, and he...
This is around 1952 when 1952, he gets out of prison.
When he's out of prison, exactly, yeah.
So he would have spent, 8 years?
6 years.
Six years, okay. Yeah.
While he's the Detroit minister, he is extraordinarily successful. He starts to grow the congregation. And some of it is just on the power of how he spoke. Anyone listening, if you haven't heard him speak, get onto YouTube look him up. He's an unbelievable speaker. It's really, really incredible. And it's one of the things that first drew me to Malcolm X. I was like, this guy is, you know, I'm always interested in people who are good at public speaking because I just think there's very few of them around.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Especially these days. Name a political leader who's good at it. There are not many. I think Barack Obama's probably the last one I can think of who was any good. Not that you necessarily love all this politics or whatever, but, you know, just as the art of speaking. Anyway, he's brilliant at this, so that's also recognised. And Elijah Muhammad gives him the role of national spokesman. He's that effective that he's now sort of acting as Elijah Muhammad's sort of his mouthpiece, his loudspeaker. He starts to appear on radio. He's being interviewed, and he's so successful that he grows the Nation of Islam from. There were 500, 600, 700. But 1963, there's 30,000 members of the Nation of Islam. And a lot of that is down to him. A lot of that is down to his charisma and his speech giving and his ability to debate points without losing his temper. And to speak with moral authority and really just defeat the flimsy arguments that would be thrown up against him by, you know, let's be real, white sort of the white media establishment. So his principal aim is he wants to inspire, or the principal reason, or maybe the principal sort of draw, I think, for a lot of young black men is that Malcolm X spoke about pride in African traits, you know, having pride in not trying to do the things that would make you acceptable necessarily to the white society, but being proud in how you look. And There was instances, and it shows it in the movie, where he's dyeing his hair.
Yes.
Doing things like he's really against that.
Or he uses the chemical.
And it burns. It burns their scalps.
Because he thinks it would make him look whiter or something like that. Yeah. So this level of brainwashing by the society.
That's the level of society level of brainwashing. Yeah,
whereas later when he's doing his speeches, he's even in the movie, he's shouting in the street and he's like, black is beautiful and all this type of thing, which is, obviously a phrase you hear.
Yeah.
to this day, yeah.
And so you can see why people get drawn to this. You can see why people will be drawn to the Nation of Islam. He also encourages people to get involved with businesses and setting up black owned businesses.
Yes, because that's a big part of like looking around and saying that, you know, we don't own anything.
Yeah.
We don't own anything. The things that exist in our neighborhoods, they don't actually benefit us. Yeah. We are continuously pushed down.
When you go here, you're paying the white man for that. When you go there, you're paying the white man for this. When you go, you know, everything is paying the white man all the time.
So you encourage sort of self-sufficiency, that type of thing. Yeah.
Again, it's the Garveyism thing. It's the, you know, and all of these things are tying together in a sort of religious fervor, you know.
Yeah, but counterintuitively to what one might think about for a civil rights leader, he's advocating racial segregation and separation and black supremacy to an extent, right?
At this time in his life. But that was the ethos of the Nation of Islam.
Absolutely. The Nation of Islam is all about separation, the white devil. Like, the whites are bad, they're wrong, they're evil, you know. And obviously, look, there's some truth in that, but it's like they're avowedly anti-white,
mm-hmm.
And it's all very heavily charged in racial terms all the time. While he's sort of working as the national spokesman, this is around the time where he meets his Betty, who becomes his wife, and he also founds a group within the Nation of Islam, which is called the Fruit of Islam. Which is the FOI. And they're like a hardcore group of men who are within the Nation of Islam. They spend their time being extraordinarily disciplined. They learn martial arts as another form of sort of like self-control and discipline and stuff. And they're the guys who are his like hardcore supporters. They're the guys who...
Marshalling and meetings.
Yeah, they control crowds. They're the guys who stand at the door. They protect people. You know, if a woman was going into a neighborhood where she might be abused, someone from the Fruit of Islam will go with her to protect her, or two or three of them might go with her to protect her. They're seen as these exemplars of the Nation of Islam. They're the great hardcore, and they form around him like this, like honor guard almost. You know, they go everywhere with him. They protect him.
And this is what you see in the movie. This sort of almost some martial element when they're controlling the meetings.
Malcolm X is also at this point, he's making appearances in Harlem in New York, where he's all over the country, because he's becoming so effective at driving memberships and stuff that Elijah Muhammad doesn't want to tie him to Detroit, obviously, because that's a waste of time. Let's get him go to Boston. So he spends time as the minister in Boston. He spends time as the minister in Harlem. There's an incident then which I think needs to be mentioned. In 1957, Johnson X Hinton, a member of the Nation of Islam, is outside the temple in Harlem, and he's seen taking suits for the Fruit of Islam to wear.
Mm-hmm.
He's seen taking them out of a car to be brought into the temple so that they were ready for the guys for the service. And he's seen by the police taking out, you know, lots of suits, and they assume, because of course they do, that he's stolen the suits,
mm-hmm.
and they arrest him and they beat the living hell out of him.
Mm.
He is dragged to a police station, thrown in a cell, not given any medical attention at all. I mean, the guy is like head injuries, his face is smashed in, he's missing teeth, he breaks fingers, and he's just left in this jail cell. The incident comes to Malcolm's attention, and he does something pretty extraordinary. He rounds up the Fruit of Islam, all the lads, and they march to the police station. He goes into the police
station.
This
is in the film.
Goes into the police station and demands that they release him and they let him get medical attention. Hinton is brought to the hospital. A crowd starts to form, bigger crowd. The Fruit of Islam controlling the crowd starts to form outside the station, then outside the hospital. This makes the national news. It's on television. People are seeing this everywhere. And whatever profile Malcolm might have had, it's now, his profile is on fire now. Like, he's like, this is the nightly news, you know. They want assurances that Hinton will be okay. The doctors come to speak to Malcolm and tell him he is going to be all right. The police are obviously at the scene at this point because there's a big, big crowd. The Nation of Islam are standing in line in suits, protecting the entrance to the hospital from the crowd, who are understandably emotional because another one of their community has been
brutalized
for no reason at all. And at this point, Malcolm X is told Hinton will be okay, he'll survive, and he comes out to the crowd and disperses the entire crowd by just waving his hand. And that's like an incredible display of the guy's charisma and his power within the community. And that's where the famous line with the police chief is supposed to have said, no one man should have all this power.
Yeah. And is that in the biography?
Yeah, he's supposed to have said that. That's what they say, yeah.
Hinton later.
Did he actually say, yeah?
Yeah.
But yeah, apparently he did.
And Hinton, who was beaten by the police into an inch of his life or whatever, he later sued the New York Police Department. And he won like one of the largest settlements in history. So,
Yeah. Which is nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. But
a happy ending. No, we're not done yet. Go on.
I mean, I don't know if I call it happy. Did they nearly murder him? Like, in 1962, the same thing basically happens again. A guy called Ronald Stokes is sort of, he gets into a confrontation with police and they shoot him. And this leads to members of the Nation of Islam sort of erupting in what the police call a riot. And Ronald Stokes is killed. He's murdered. And when it comes to court, the police, when they're brought to court over this, the court case lasts for 25 minutes. And they're obviously, you know, just going to be a problem. 11 men. There's like 11 men. There's a big shooting and whatever.
I assume they're all convicted. All of the police.
11 men are brought on charges. 11 of the Nation of Islam members are brought on charges of firing weapons. They're all found guilty, of course, like standard. The police don't. Nothing happens to them. Like, so at this point, Malcolm X becomes absolutely incensed. So you can imagine, like, this big riot is kicked off. People are shooting at each other. All the black guys who were involved go to prison. The police who started this fucking thing, nothing.
Yes, fine. But at least everything has changed since then.
Yeah, exactly right. He's incensed. But it's at this point that the Malcolm X becomes really, really embedded into the ongoing civil rights movement that is obviously happening in the US at the same time with Dr. King and so on. And he calls for the unity of all the black groups at this point because he's so incensed that this was done on racial grounds rather than religious grounds or anything like that. But here's where he starts to shift towards and starts spending more of his time working on sort of racial equality outside of necessarily the tenets of Elijah Muhammad, if that makes sense. So we start, this is a gradual move which over time begins to annoy Elijah Muhammad.
Yeah, because he's brought like a heightened profile to the group and helped build it. And of course, it's been a copacetic relationship between the two because Malcolm X is a rising star but also the Nation of Islam is growing with his help and vice versa. But yeah, as he starts to not diverge, but like his area of focus shifts a little bit towards racial equality.
And this doesn't go down well with the other members of the leadership that are around Elijah Muhammad, the Nation of Islam. And people internally are speaking against Malcolm. He doesn't really care about you, and he's in this for himself. And look at his national profile; it's way too big. This is about you. You're the prophet, not him. And you know all of this kind of stuff. And there's factionalism begins in the Nation of Islam here, and at this point, it's confided in Malcolm that Elijah Muhammad has not been practicing what he's preaching. And again, this is in the movie where it shows that he's got multiple children by various different women who are associated with the Nation of Islam. The severity to which he's engaging in like abuse of these women is debated. It can be argued, but like no matter what way you cut this, it ain't good. Like this guy is not behaving he's not displaying discipline. He's not displaying piety. He's not displaying respect.
He's not practicing what he preaches.
He's not practicing what he preaches. Yeah. He's not displaying respect for his wife. And much like the leaders of most cults or religions, he's not doing it himself. You know. Malcolm X becomes distraught at this, like really.
Yeah.
He's absolutely distraught at this, like, and he wrestles with what he should do about it. And part of him, you know, in Manny Marable's biography, part of him is thinks he should just walk out. Part of him thinks, well, Elijah Muhammad's allowed to do that because he's the prophet and that's okay. And that's a real thought.
He said, I felt almost out of my mind.
Yeah.
Like he was, I suppose it's like
this thing that had anchored him maybe since prison, and that he had put all his energy into and his belief, and now this was kind of shattering his belief in Elijah, you know.
So Elijah Muhammad eventually is pressured and he admits that this is true and he has these kids, and that's in 63, and this is like a major mental struggle for Malcolm X, because he remember who this guy is to him. Like, you know, he reveres him as the man who saved him, you know, but he's not practicing the religion in truth. So his sort of one of the reasons he decides he's going to go on a Hajj. So he's going to go on a pilgrimage to Mecca, which is a. So you're
sorry.
Going,
yeah.
Going
no, I was just wondering. So in the film, I believe he finds out that the Nation of Islam is planning to try to have him assassinated before he goes on this Hajj and everything. And they cut ties before then. I don't know what is the timeline in reality.
No, he doesn't cut. So Elijah Muhammad admits this in 63. There is talk of division. Some people are saying horrible things like this guy should, like Louis X. Farrakhan, who's the current leader of the Nation of Islam, is alleged, now I was alleged to have said that he should be beheaded, Malcolm X, should be beheaded for this. So the talk of, like, are they planning it? It's difficult to say if they actually were planning something.
Because in the film, it's like, someone's like, hey, they told me to wire your car so it would explode.
Yeah, like, it's difficult. Oh. Like. The other thing is, people would be extraordinarily paranoid because he is being phone tapped by the FBI. At this point, he's being followed around by the FBI, and there is talk that maybe the FBI are going to kill him.
And he's been censored as well by Elijah.
Yes.
Because of the comments he made after JFK's assassination, you know? So I think the
relationship is coming to an end.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't know if we did chickens coming home to roost, right? Like, basically, he deserved what he got, or like, this is what happens when you build a racist and violent society, sort of thing.
A corrupt society will breed this type of thing, yeah.
In 64, Malcolm X decides to go on a Hajj, go on a pilgrimage to Mecca, which is sort of one of the principal tenets of Islam. And this is absolutely transformative. It's like mind blowing for him when he does this. And the movie does a good job of it, and it's really heavily weighted in the biographies that when he's there, he's sort of given a crash course intro to, I guess, what he might refer to as true Islam, real Islam, Islam outside of this nation.
As a kind of a brotherhood of man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not about
race.
And when he's there, he, and the movie does a good job of this as well, like, he sort of comes across Muslims of all ethnic backgrounds, and he engages with the sort of elder Muslims, and they say to him, like, Elijah Muhammad is, that's not Islam. Like, there's one prophet, there's the final prophet, and that is Muhammad. And we don't speak in racial terms. Yeah. Islam's not about race. You know, anyone can be a Muslim and so on. And in his time in Saudi Arabia, he is transformed, but he's also invited into the sort of the house of notable men, and he's like learning from people, and he's asked to speak at various events, and he ends up travels all around Africa. Yeah, he's into Egypt and all around North Africa, and he is. Speaking about race relations at this time, he's telling the world about how black Americans are being treated in America. Obviously, if you're the FBI, this is fairly damning. It's the height of the Cold War. You've got a famous American who's from an ethnic minority that you have abused and plundered since the dawn of the country's existence, and he's basically telling everyone, this is what you're actually like. This is what America is actually like.
And this is what he converts at this stage to Sunni.
He converts Islam to Sunni Islam, yeah, at this point. Yeah.
And this is when he takes the name as well, El Hajj Malik El Shabazz.
Yeah. El Hajj Malik El Shabazz. So that becomes his Islamic name.
There was a quote I saw when he came back from the Hajj and how he described it, and it kind of stayed with me. So it was, the true brotherhood I have seen had influenced me to recognize that anger can blind human vision. And afterwards, so he, I suppose, it's safe to say he moderated his views.
Yeah, like his views become much more nuanced, much more complex, much more much more sort of real world and sort of much more nuanced, I guess.
Would it be aligned more to kind of Martin Luther King's
definitely,
vision?
Definitely softens towards King.
Yeah.
Like if you'd argue the debate between the two men, and it would often be done, you know, Malcolm X is more militant and King is more pacifist. In the timeline, Malcolm X moves more towards King than King ever moves towards Malcolm X, you know, in terms of his views. He comes back to the US in 1964, and at this point this is when he formally breaks
with the Nation of Islam.
Yeah. And he does that by founding his own organization, which he calls Muslim Mosque Inc. And I just love that name. That's great. I just like the alliteration.
And the Organization of African American Unity.
Yes. As well. Yeah. And that is explicitly to work towards civil rights with the likes of King and other great civil rights leaders.
And the organization identified racism and not any particular race.
Yeah, racism as a concept rather than one group as another. Yeah.
The enemy of justice, he described it as, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he had a bit of a transformation, a spiritual transformation, really. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like a second spiritual awakening, I suppose, is kind of how to think of it. But he's splitting his time very much between these two organizations. But at the same time, of course, the Nation of Islam are furious because their main spokesperson, it's all coming to a head, and now he's splintered he's splintered their movement, because he's pulled some of the Nation of Islam have broken away and gone with him, because they see Elijah Muhammad and they think, and then Malcolm X comes back and he said, well, that's not actually Islam. Here's what Islam is, and it's way better. Do you know what I mean? It's much more.
But also by him embracing Sunni Islam as well, he is, by definition, then rejecting.
Of course.
The fact
he's rejecting that Elijah Muhammad as a prophet. Yeah, you can't believe that if you're Sunni.
So that's clearly going to anger Elijah's followers.
And the death threats keep coming.
Yeah.
But this time, this is really severe now at this point. He's also, again, just to point it out again, he's also being followed around and wiretapped and phone tapped by the FBI this whole time because they fear him as a demagogue, you know. He becomes really an international civil rights leader. At one point he's like he really embarrasses the US by asking the UN to intervene in American national or home policy, like in their treatment of the races. And I'm laughing at that just because of the audaciousness of that,
because because he identified as a human rights issue,
yes,
the way that black Americans are being treated.
Difficult to argue with that, very difficult to argue
with the head of the UN the seat of the UN in New York as well,
it's very difficult to argue with it. Like, so you can imagine if you're a dyed-in-the-wool hardcore member of the establishment, this guy is speaking some real truth to power here. This guy is like really upsetting the Apple.
And around this time, I believe his house is firebombed as well, much like it was when he was 5 years old. This is when he's, trying to make his autobiography, saying it'd be a miracle if he's still alive. Yeah. In the movie, he says it's a time for martyrs, like
the famous photo with the is it an assault rifle he has at the window as well?
Yeah.
Looking out the window.
He has the sort of the hardcore guys, a lot of them who would have been Fruit of Islam, who are with him, like, are constantly armed, an armed guard around him all the time. And yeah, his house is firebombed just like it was when he was a child. It culminates essentially in him delivering a speech in 65, I think. And it's essentially, there's an order comes down, allegedly, from the Nation of Islam, to attack this speech when he's on stage,
because it's not a subtle affair. His assassination.
It's not subtle. No, they go in and they just unleash hell. Like, they just go in and start firing, and he's cut down on stage and murdered in front of everyone. Mm. 39 years old, murdered in public, on stage. Preaching civil rights.
Few months before Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's absolutely tragic. Like, it's a horrific tragedy. Like, they both go in the same span of 6 months,
and the loss of those two giants, really.
Yeah.
I mean,
these men at this point are obviously, they're icons of American history, but they're international civil rights leaders. You know, that's not an understatement. These were Malcolm X is an iconic international figure.
And he, Malcolm X as well was inspiring like the likes of Mandela.
Absolutely.
He was locked up in Absolutely. Robben Island.
How could you not be? If you're Mandela, how could you not be inspired by Malcolm X? You know?
And he quotes him several times in his Mandela as well quotes him in his autobiography as well like that. So he had a big, like you said, his influence stretched beyond America.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Manny Marable as well, the biographer, Marable has a thing about like, did Malcolm X know or did he not know he was going to be killed when he went to do this speech and go anyway? And he expected to die. And that's borne out by his quote to the biographer, Haley's biographer, if this comes out before I'm dead, it'll be a miracle kind of thing, you know? And a lot of people believe he knew he was going to be killed.
And he did claim when he was alive that he didn't fear death.
Yeah.
You know, that he is.
And that's the line about him. Like, he didn't fear death because he loved us so. Mm. That's the line they say about him, you know.
Yeah, just a slight correction. This was in 65, like you were saying. 68. Martin Luther King was 68. So it was like 6 months between JFK and Martin Luther King.
Yes, that's what we're getting confused. Yeah. That's what we're getting confused.
But it's basically like, it's the same. It's barely any time between.
Yeah, it's no time at all.
It's all part of the same movements.
Yes.
You know.
And I think the debate about whether or not he knew he was going to die, I think is kind of a moot point nearly because that he was going to be killed is a moot point whether or not he knew he was going to be killed that night because he knew he was going to be killed one way or another. He knew this was coming to a head. They firebombed his house, as we said, you know. The show in the movie as well is they keep calling his house and his wife is like, you know, being harassed. It's just, it's constant. And this is just at him all the time. You know, and it's been going on for a long time.
He must have had amazing mental fortitude.
Incredible, like.
And his family put up with it as well.
That would break anyone, like. That would break anyone, you know. And
especially if he saw, say, his what, because he had a few children and his wife seeing how much they were suffering as well, you know.
His daughters, yeah.
And to have the strength to keep going, you know.
So in a lot of ways, I think it's interesting because he's ultimately, despite being so young when his father's taken from him, he ends up being quite reflective of his father. In a lot of ways, having that kind of facing the most horrific adversity and still having the mental strength to continue, like, so it's an interesting study in psychology, if nothing else, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, as far as his assassination, like, it's members of Islam that are doing it. It's hinted at in the film that it's not just the Nation of Islam. They might be getting help, you know, that the FBI might be involved.
This, it gets murky. Like every assassination at that time, there's a lot of talk and it is murky.
There are people who fully believe, no, this was a government job. He was taken out by the FBI. Like that, there are people who believe that that's the case.
The man who, like, three of them were convicted, and I believe that one of them admitted to it.
Yeah.
And the two others were exonerated only a few years ago.
Yeah.
You know, so it was considered a gross miscarriage of justice that the two others were in prison, you know, that were accused of it. So.
And look, I mean, you know, the very fact that it is murky and there are these questions about it is just further evidence. If this was a white public figure, none of that would have happened. We all know that's true. Like, you know, there wouldn't have been this, or who was involved, or the government involved, you know.
Well,
people do
that with JFK's murder as well, to be fair.
Yeah, but nobody sensible does that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, true. You know what I mean? Here, it feels like there is more of an argument to be made.
Yeah, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not great, is it?
No, it's not brilliant.
a summary of race relations.
But yeah, I think... yeah, you can see why I find him so charismatic and so
magnetic.
Why I'm interested. I just think the just incredible intellectual bravery, and also I like that, you know, you see somebody who can admit they're wrong about something, change their view, and not lose any
do so publicly,
yeah. and not accept that means a loss of any kind of dignity.
Whereas now,
I think people need that. Yeah, now, you know,
you never. It's very rare that you'd hear a politician or a public figure.
No one ever missed
an error.
You don't even get everyday folks on Twitter doing that. Like, no one ever missed a wrong about anything. It's ridiculous. Like, you know, and I just think he's a fascinating figure from that perspective. And
I think it was a great pick to get us onto, Mark. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and as you said, 39 years old.
39. Yeah.
Sad as always to imagine what he could have achieved.
The prime of life.
Given the rest of his life to work with, but his legacy lives on as is depicted in the film. And, you know, Spike Lee, obviously has strong feelings about civil rights and, you know, black empowerment, and mm-hmm. that is a theme throughout the film.
Yeah, absolutely.
It ends with a montage. We see Nelson Mandela appear in the final moments of the film as well.
Yeah, and he kind of quotes a famous Malcolm X quote that I have here, but it's very long, so I don't know if I would put you through it all. But Mandela refused to say the last four words, which were "by any means necessary." And you can imagine what that meant in terms of achieving your rights and that type of thing. They did differ in maybe their methods later in life, obviously.
Yeah.
Mandela had a lot of time in prison and changed his views as well, you know?
Yeah. But I think he deserves, Malcolm X deserves to be considered along with Mandela in that sort of echelon of iconic civil rights figures. In my view,
I feel like it's often said that every movement needs a Malcolm X alongside a Martin Luther King, yeah. right?
Yeah.
Like someone to, like they're kind of shown as a dichotomy, even though they're obviously fighting for the same thing, yeah. just doing it with different methods.
You see it often in political movements for sure, or in foundation of countries. One I think about is like the early days of Israel, and you've got Menachem Begin and David Ben-Gurion, and they're sort of the two polarizing. They're both fighting for Israel, obviously, and they're both fighting for whatever, but they have like polarizing views and, you know, political adversaries and so on.
The Irish Civil War,
Irish Civil War, yeah, for sure.
Michael Collins, etc.
Yeah.
And what's his name? I was just reading about this earlier.
De Valera.
Yeah,
that's it.
But Martin Luther King as well, he had great respect for Malcolm X, and when he was asked about it after his assassination, you know, he said we differed in our methods, but we had the same goal.
Yeah.
And Malcolm X himself, you know, famously said that after he sort of reconciled with Martin Luther King's goals after he came back from the Hajj, he said, you know, Dr. King wants the same thing I want, freedom.
Yeah.
I think that's the part that sort of struck me with the film, that he was able to change his mind, because obviously some of the earlier views of the Nation of Islam and all that are very problematic.
Yes.
But he was able to kind of see the errors in his ways and change course and go against an organization he'd helped to build as well. Yeah. So I don't know, I think you can really see the strength of character that the man had. Yeah.
Yeah.
I wish I had half of it, or a tenth of it.
Same. Maybe I'll ask you, Mark, as well, any sources, the ones you were reading, beyond the autobiography itself?
Well, beyond the autobiography, the main one I read was, it's sort of the famous, the most famous, I guess, biography of Malcolm X, which is by Manning Marable. Manning Marable is won the Pulitzer Prize for this biography. It's in-depth. It is brilliant. Like when I looked at these notes, I don't actually remember writing these notes, as I said to you, so I must have written them a long time ago. But when I was looking at it there, I was thinking to myself, I must have spent a lot of time cutting stuff out of what I was going to say, because I'm obviously very conscious of the running time. Because that biography really gets into like his relationship with his siblings and his wife and his kids, and you know,
it's really gets into it.
And it gives a brilliant. Like, I could have spent the whole episode talking about the Fruit of Islam and the guys who were the closest to him and his closest disciples and stuff, because they have, you know, incredibly close relationships and you know, sort of bonds of brotherhood and stuff with those guys. It's pretty interesting. Like, but yeah, that would be the biography I'd recommend.
Mm.
It is on Audible as well, if you wanted to just listen to it. I would recommend that.
And I thought what was interesting, just even in terms of you mentioning, Mark, how he is respected all over the world to this day. Apart from documentaries, this was the first film that was given permission to actually film around Mecca.
Yeah.
So, you know, that scene. Originally, they were thinking they were going to have to do the film it in somewhere in the States. Can you imagine trying to recreate that?
Recreating Mecca?
Yeah, somewhere like...
Difficult.
New York State.
Very difficult to do.
So it'll kind of show... But Spike Lee pushed for it, and he pushed the studio to finance it as well. And I think that'll show you the respect.
The fact that they allowed it to be done,
The international respect out there for him, yeah.
Yeah.
For sure. That is a good piece of trivia to finish up with, maybe. Thank you for listening. We are going to dive into, as always, more detail, maybe not on this one, or maybe randomly on this one, we will see, in our footnotes and fancies episodes that we put out on our Patreon, patreon.com/realhistorypodcast.
It's very cheap. It's very, very cheap.
It is very cheap.
Just saying.
We are cheap. And you can also...
I don't think it's good telling people, like, we're cheap. Okay.
Anything that gets us an L subscriber, Mick, you know?
But if you don't want to go to the Patreon, we would appreciate a review on Apple Podcasts or your podcatcher of choice. And you can, of course, find all of our other shows and projects at showswhatyouknow.com. Anything else?
No.
I think I've spoken enough for a day, haven't I? I mean, yeah. I think I've spoken enough.
Well, you think so now, but we have Patreon stuff to record. So let's get another beer and let's get going. Thank you all for listening. For now, that's the end of the reel.
Thank you. Bye.
Cheers.